From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as we prepare for the inauguration of our new president, we talk about the state of American politics with someone who had hoped to be the next president, Bill Bradley. He served in the U.S. Senate for nearly 20 years. His latest book is called The Journey From Here. Also today, now that life expectancy is longer than it used to be, older people are experiencing new sorts of medical problems. We'll talk about them with Dr. Muriel Gillick, who's written a new book about living longer and growing frail. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new series of live performances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. California power officials have suspended the rolling blackouts they used to conserve power earlier in the day, but they say there may be more power cuts during the peak usage period that begins in about an hour. The officials say they were able to stop the blackouts because they got an emergency supply of power from Canada. Jim Detmers, a manager of the state's utility grid, said there are other strategies officials can use to save electricity, including shutting down the huge pumps that bring water from the northern part of the state to the south.
We are exhausting water resources now that could be used to minimize the impact of further rotating outages later this afternoon.
Detmers and other officials are urging Californians to take all possible steps to conserve power. Two women were the stars of a Senate confirmation hearing today. One was the governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, who's President-elect Bush's choice for EPA administrator. The other was the new senator from New York, Hillary Clinton. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The task today for the Senate Environment Committee was to see if Governor Whitman was up to leading the nation's top environmental agency. And while there were questions about her support for letting industries do their own environmental auditing, the hearing drew special interest because it was the debut of Hillary Clinton as the working senator from New York. Clinton told Whitman she planned to propose legislation giving consumers information more quickly about the quality of their drinking water.
And I would look forward to working with you and your staff at the EPA and coming up with some legislation if you would be interested in pursuing that.
I'd be happy to work with you.
Thank you.
Those issues.
Thank you.
Whitman dodged questions about whether the Bush administration will continue efforts to curtail diesel emissions. She said she would vigorously enforce the law, but believe the carrot worked better than the stick. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The fate of Congolese President Laurent Kabila is still unknown. There are conflicting reports as to whether he was killed yesterday in an assassination attempt. Congolese officials have named Kabila's son Joseph as the interim ruler, but his future is uncertain. Nicholas Long reports from Kinshasa.
His son, Joseph Kabila, has already been appointed interim head of the government by an extraordinary cabinet meeting. The government is not saying at this stage whether Joseph Kabila could be a long-term head of state. They are saying that the important thing at the moment is to assure public order and security. And I think most of the population of Kinshasa would agree that that is the priority. Because, remember, this city of Kinshasa has a sad history of being sacked by the army. That happened twice, once in 1991 and again in 1993.
Nicholas Long reporting from Kinshasa. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 68 points to close at 10,584 in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. The head of Palestinian State Television was assassinated today in the Gaza Strip. Israel denied any connection to the murder of Hisham Mickey, who was described as an associate of Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat. The Palestinian Authority said the murder was the work of collaborators with Israel. Witnesses said Mickey was gunned down by three masked men in a hotel. Israel has accused the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation of inciting hatred during the current Palestinian uprising. The organization denies any wrongdoing. A new study has found some big problems in the way public high schools prepare teenagers. NPR's Claudia Sanchez reports.
American high schools today are sorting machines. They don't adequately prepare students for life after high school. The curriculum often has little to do with what college and the world of work require. And the high school diploma is meaningless as a standard of academic achievement. These are the preliminary findings of a National Commission on High School appointed by U.S. Education Secretary Richard Riley. One of the greatest concerns is what students learn during their senior year. Very little, the commission says. It's calling on high schools to combine rigorous academics and technical training into a single track. The commission will spend the next few months conducting public hearings on the issue. A final report is due in June. I'm Claudia Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Former Union Chief Leonard Woodcock has died at his home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He was 89. Woodcock was president of the United Auto Workers from 1970 to 1977. He served as ambassador to China during the Carter administration. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 64 points to close at 2683. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, saluting cultural programming on NPR, the recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With our new president taking office on Saturday, politics is on our minds. My guest Bill Bradley reflects on American politics in his recent book, The Journey from Here. Not too long ago, Bradley hoped to be the next president. He ran in the Democratic primary. He represented New Jersey in the U.S. Senate from 1979 to 97. Before entering politics, he was a basketball star, playing with the New York Knicks from 1967 to 77. In 1982, Bradley was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame. As we look ahead to the inauguration, I'm wondering if you're watching and thinking, it could have been me, or I wish it was me.
Well, in a way, yes, but I think that that passed during the course of the campaign itself. I think that there's only one reason to run for president of the United States, and that is that you think that your leadership is what the country needs at that particular time in its history. That's why I ran. The people in the Democratic Party decided that that was not to be me to have that chance. And so I think you adapt, you accept, and you move on.
You know, in this inaugural week, I have a real question for you, which is, and you've partly answered it, but I want to hear more. Why would anyone in their right mind want to be president? Now, not that anyone's asking me to be president, but I know, you know, I can't imagine having that kind of responsibility, the burdens of the country and the world on your shoulders.
Well, I think that, as I said, there's only one reason to want to be president of the United States, and that is because you think that your leadership at this particular time in our nation's history can improve the quality of life for millions of Americans. I think that that is by far the main reason to run. I suppose people run for other reasons, some obvious, some less obvious, some deep in their psyche, some more clear to the observer. Relating to power, relating to their own unresolved issues. But I think that the real question is, for me, was the only reason to do this, because it is a tremendous sacrifice. You're essentially giving your life up for your country, is because you think your leadership will make a difference in the lives of people. And it's a form of service, and it's the ultimate service and the ultimate dedication to your country.
When you withdrew from the primary, was there at least a part of you that was relieved to be getting out?
Well, no, I would say I was not relieved to be getting out, because I wanted to be president. I wanted to enact an agenda that meant a lot to me, that I thought the country needed in terms of health care and education, the environment and race, etc. And so getting out was the loss of the opportunity to do that. The president has the bully pulpit, is the only leader in the country. I mean, no other politician is really known, because the TV is in the president's face every day. And so people get a chance to really know him. And that means that he has a chance to shape their view of themselves as well as the country. So I was disappointed not to have that chance. On the liberation side, I suppose a part of me was glad to get back in a car and drive on the highways at my own speed. I mean, that's how I relax. And when you're in a campaign, you can't really do that because of the Secret Service.
Let's talk about negative politics. When you started your primary campaign, you said you hoped to run a completely positive campaign. Didn't work out that way. Do you think it's possible to run a completely positive campaign?
What I said was I wanted to, the premise of my campaign was to go out and tell people what you really believe and win. And it proved that I didn't win. There were probably reasons other than that. But that one of the factors is that in the course of the campaign, if you do not respond to negative attacks on you, you essentially allow people to define you by the negative attacks. And that is an experience that I had in the course of the campaign that I think discouraged me from believing that you can run just a positive campaign and win. That's what I tried to do, and I was hurt by doing that. In fact, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, you should have struck back harder, sooner, longer, more intensely. They wanted the fight. They wanted the negative response to the negative attack. And
Actually, I heard criticisms on both sides. Some people said, you said you'd stick to the high road, you should have stayed there. And other people said, you should have fought back harder and swifter and sooner.
That's the catch-22, isn't it? I mean, everyone wants you to be the experiment. And the reality is that when I decided to respond aggressively, let's say after Iowa, which I had lost, and I refused to go negative in Iowa, and I lost. When I went to New Hampshire, I actually took some very pointed criticisms of my opponent, and in a week I went from 18 points behind to 4 points behind, narrowly losing the race. And so I think that, you know, you have to, it's not easy to say, but I think that you have to be clear about what you believe and decide you're going to run a campaign that way. And when you do attack, not attack on the basis of ad hominem attacks, but on the basis of a record.
Well, among the things you said about Al Gore was that he was using scare tactics in the way he described your health care policy, and that you also accused Gore of meanness in politics. I'm wondering during a primary if it's in back of your mind, well, if I say negative things about the other Democratic candidate now, will that be used against the party in the latter part of the campaign?
Sure. That's always in the back of your mind because you're first of all a Democrat and you want to win the race. So, that was in the back of my mind.
But you live with that?
You ultimately temper what you say so that you try to be direct, but at the same time, you don't go so far overboard in one direction that you might actually end up helping the other party.
What about the whole, like, charisma issue? I mean, one of the things that you were criticized for by some people in the press was sometimes giving dull speeches. charisma is such the thing now in politics.
Charisma would make a difference if they carried your whole speech, but they don't carry your whole speech. They only carry a bite, sound bite of the speech. And then there's a judgment that, A, you're this or that. And I found that, you know, when I was in rooms of 50, 100, 400 people, that I could talk to them, and I felt that, you know, I was reaching them. I could see their eyes. In the book, I talk about, you know, speaking to a group of people and seeing a connection in their eyes and seeing these as people who were identified with me and wanting to knit them together into a broader stream of idealism in the country. And the challenge, I saw that happening when I spoke. I was not deceived by that. A lot of people didn't see that. I did. And I think that the key thing here is that there is an inherent limitation. And charisma is really what the press says it is. It's not, it doesn't exist in the mind of a lot of people. People listen to you. They respond to you. And they respond to a lot of things. I mean, you can be flamboyant or you can be sincere. And in some cases, sincerity beats flamboyance.
We're looking at American politics with former senator, former presidential candidate, and former Knicks star Bill Bradley. His latest book is called The Journey From Here. You served in the Senate from 1978 to 1996. What are some of the greatest changes you've seen in congressional politics from the time when you started in politics?
Well, it used to be that you were elected in a campaign, hard fought. There was a winner and a loser. If you were the winner, you went to the Senate. You became a senator. And then, you know, maybe 18 months, max 2 years before your next election, you started in the candidate mode again. Now, the electioneering never stops. Amendments are offered from the floor of the Senate that are not substantive amendments, but are political amendments meant to get people on the record so somebody can run a negative commercial about that person. There are strategies that are primarily devised by interest groups as opposed to senators and their staffs that are aimed at essentially improving the chances of the interest group to raise money and to polarize as opposed to legislate. And I think that those changes are detrimental. Money's a big difference. I mean, you know, I remember my first campaign for the United States Senate in New Jersey, I raised about $1.2 million or $1.3 million. The person who won the Senate race in New Jersey this year spent $60 million of his own money. That's different. And if you are a politician, you're spending all your time raising money, you're not spending time doing the work that the people sent you to Washington to do. And because more and more money is needed to run these campaigns, that's a big difference than when I came into the Senate in 1978.
What about the style of discourse in Congress? Do you think that's changed?
Well, it's become less a place where people make speeches and more a place where people speak sound bites. And there are still speeches made on the Senate floor, but it is not the same as it was on an evening in a heated debate when Russell Long of Louisiana would take the floor and wax eloquent and funny and threatening to, you know, the assembled senators. Now it is much more a matter of fewer bipartisan coalitions and more lining people up in your party and having two sides go to war. For example, there were a lot of bills in my first term in the Senate, and there were bills in my second term in the Senate, where you put together a bipartisan coalition. You might have a regional coalition. You might have the upper Midwest and the Northeast that would be against the South and the Southwest. You might have the far West and the East against the Midwest. Or there could be a lot of different regional coalitions. And then you found a lot of people who were essentially common sense legislators. And they would occasionally buck their party. And they would do so on a somewhat regular basis. And that meant that there were always a floating number of votes, 15 or 20, that if you were a serious legislator, you could put together. And if you worked with them on both sides of the aisle, you had a chance to get something done. Now it's primarily two leaders negotiating a deal before anything happens and then just simply playing out the deal.
My guest is Bill Bradley. His latest book is called The Journey From Here. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Bradley, and we're talking about the state of American politics. He's a former senator, former presidential candidate, and former star of the Knicks. What role would you like to see President Clinton play after he leaves the White House? What role would you like to see him play within the party?
I'd like to see him have a lot of time for reflection and write his memoirs. I think that that's the best thing that he could do.
Why?
Because I think that he could have something to say that the country would benefit from. I think his role in the party is going to be determined really by the dynamic of the next couple of years. I think that I don't think there's ever been a president who's retired and essentially sought to play a role in the party. Now, maybe he will. I mean, certainly I wouldn't put it past him for trying to do that. And I think some people will want him to do that. And it'll focus on...
It sounds like you don't want him to do that.
Well, I think that he ought to take a little time off, that's what I think, and write his memoirs. He can always come back. But I think that, if anyone should play the role of the leader of the party, it's the person who was nominated by the party, which is Al Gore. And I think that that is, unfortunately, difficult to do if you have a president who seeks to do that himself, a former president. So I question whether, in the long run, it'll be that helpful for the party. But I think he's a man of great talent, and he has deep conviction about some issues, and he likes the fray. And so I don't know what ultimately he'll end up doing.
What role would you like to see Al Gore play in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think that he is the person who was the nominee, and I think that he should be given a certain right to be heard and a right to lead the party in when they're in opposition.
Now, it's interesting to hear you say that about him since he was your opponent.
Well, but I lost to him. And, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. And part of the spoils is appointing, is taking over that role. I mean, certainly I'll try to have my voice heard. But I think ultimately, for example, the head of the Democratic National Committee, I think that Al Gore should have had as great a voice as President Clinton in who that person would be. And I think that, to me, that's a good way to proceed.
How do you see the Clinton legacy, for better or for worse?
Oh, I think that there will be some things that people look back and say he did very well. The budget agreement in 1993 that really set the stage for the balanced budget. The NAFTA agreement, the World Trade Organization agreement, and the most favored nation status for China all kept America engaged in the world, kept pushing open trade further, kept acknowledging the extent to which our future is inextricably entwined with the rest of the world. I think those are things that you can look at and say, you know, those were significant accomplishments. I think you can look on the other side and say that, you know, there were issues that he didn't handle well. I don't think that Russia was particularly a distinguished accomplishment. To the contrary, I think that we've lost a decade with Russia. You can look at some of the things that he did, for example, in terms of welfare reform, which when it passed was basically a Republican bill in which people supported with his urging, risking a bill that was destructive ultimately to children. Now, he ameliorated that with future actions, but the original bill was one that was difficult to take. And then I think that people will look back and see a man of enormous talent, great talent, with a very large ambition for himself and for the country, and find that it was squandered from time to time by his other failings. And I think that will be the judgment of history. I think that the most significant accomplishment, of course, will be the booming economy of this period and his attempt to redefine the Democratic Party as a party of the center and to take small steps as opposed to big steps. Now, that's not always good, in my opinion, if you're a leader.
What are you going to be doing on Inauguration Day?
You know, I haven't thought about it. I'll probably be working. I mean, I'll probably tune in and listen to George W. Bush's inauguration speech because I'm, you know, a political speaker. I like to hear what he's going to say, how he's going to say it. Other than that, I'll be getting up with my family and going to work and having a full day.
Do you feel that his legitimacy as president is at all compromised by what went on during the Florida aftermath?
Well, I think that there are a number of things. First, I think that ultimately the Supreme Court made the decision, not the people. And that is a precedent that is somewhat ominous. But what struck me was after the decision was made, how quickly people came behind. And I think that Al Gore's concession speech went some direction toward ending the conflict because he, I thought, was very gracious and made the point very well. And so I think that Bush is accepted as the president now. Now, this could be like 1824. 1824, John Quincy Adams beat Andrew Jackson in a disputed election that went to the House of Representatives. So it went even further than to the Supreme Court. or at least it took a different direction because it ended up in the House of Representatives. And, of course, that was the beginning of the movement that 4 years later culminated in Andrew Jackson being elected President of the United States. So the real question is how Democrats handle this. And my hope is that Democrats will cooperate and try to get an agenda passed, but start to build toward 2004 when we'll have a chance to demonstrate that we actually got more votes in 2000, but we're going to get more votes in 2004 in the right states.
Bill Bradley, I have one last question for you that has nothing to do with politics. And this is something that you write about a little bit in your latest book. You said that your father was disabled and that he suffered from calcified arthritis of the lower spine. He lived in constant pain. He couldn't walk more than a couple of blocks. Your mother had to dress him every morning. You became an athlete. I mean, you had glory in your body. And I'm wondering if you thought a lot about your father's imprisonment in your body during your years as a basketball star.
You know, the biggest thing about my father's circumstance was that how much I considered it just who my father was. I mean, there was no concept of disability in those years when I was growing up, and he never complained, and it was just who he was. It's true, I never saw him tie his shoes or drive a car or throw a ball or walk further than a couple of blocks. And my mother did help dress him in the morning, and I'd fix his suspenders and pick up the paper from the steps in the morning. But I never thought of my father then. And so when I think of disability today, I think of all those Americans who we consider disabled, who have the same spirit and determination as my father, and who puts the onus on us to view them as Americans, as human beings who have different attributes than we do, and but who can make as large a contribution. So I never thought of my father's disability in a sense when I was playing basketball. I guess, well, I'll take that back. Maybe I thought how lucky I was to be able to run and jump and shoot and have my body carry me forward in ways that I never saw my father able to do. So if anything, that experience created a little humility in me and also a deep sense of appreciation for good health.
Bill Bradley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Bradley's latest book is called The Journey From Here. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, caring for elderly people who have grown frail. We talk to elder care specialist Dr. Muriel Gillick, author of the new book Lifelines. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new series of recordings called Live at the Left Bank. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Life expectancy is longer than it used to be in the U.S., but the question is, what is the quality of life in those later years? Many people who live into their 80s and 90s endure a prolonged period of failing health and progressive disability. Many older people are faced with a constellation of health problems that leave them frail and unable to handle even basic activities like dressing and toileting. My guest, Dr. Muriel Gillick, directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. She's written a new book about living longer and growing frail called Lifelines. Some older people experience a taste of the so-called golden years after retirement, but eventually find themselves too frail for an independent lifestyle.
We certainly like to paint the picture of old age as a time of exploration and travel and playing, and I think that that works to some extent for vigorous older people, and the majority of older people are vigorous, but a significant fraction are not, and the older they get, the less likely they are to remain vigorous and to be able to engage in those sorts of pastimes. The other observation I would make is that it may be fine to play, to indulge in all sorts of things that are just pleasurable after you've worked hard for many years, for a few years. But we're talking about people retiring at age 65 and having a life expectancy of 20 years easily, and that may increase. That's a long time to spend engaged in solely pleasurable activities. So I would add that even if people are not impeded from doing all kinds of things that they think they would have liked to do because of physical frailty, they still want to do something meaningful with their lives, given that it's a large chunk of time.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, the vigorous elderly are media idols, those who stay strong and independent well into old age and then have the fortune to die rapidly with little fuss. Are you frustrated when you see these media idols, as you put it?
Well, I think it's great that people are able to remain vigorous into old age. I just think that we shouldn't, as you suggest, delude people into thinking that they will necessarily have that fate, and that we need to acknowledge that for many people, old age is not just a time of being full of pep and able to travel and do all the things that you never had time to do before. And I think that as physicians, we need to recognize that we're not going to be able to prevent frailty by encouraging people to exercise better and to eat better and lead righteous lives, that those are all good things to do, and they may play an important role in preventing frailty or delaying its onset for some people, but it's not going to obliterate frailty.
What do you think is the difference in the approach you might take to seeing an older person who has medical problems and side effects problems as opposed to like a general practitioner who'd be seeing the same patient?
Well, hopefully we'd have the same approach, but I think that the physician who's experienced with dealing with frail elderly individuals would start, for example, by looking at all their medications. One thing that we teach our fellows who are becoming specialists in geriatrics to do is to do brown bag medicine, by which we mean make sure that patients, if they're coming to the office, bring all their pills in a little brown bag and dump them all out on the table and find out just what it is that a person is taking. And if they're not in bottles that are labeled, they're the pink pills and the white pills and the red pills, that tells you something also. Another thing that the geriatricians are particularly comfortable doing is to get information from both the patient and from caregivers. That may be family members, it may be a hired caregiver, other individuals who are in close contact with that person, to fill out the story, to get different aspects of the story, to understand how the person is really doing. And I guess a third facet of geriatric care that's very important is to pay attention to function, not just to ask, do you have pain? Do you have trouble with your breathing? But to figure out how much that pain or the breathing problem actually gets in the way of the person leading his life.
you find that older people are sometimes less good at accurately describing their symptoms or giving you a kind of accurate report of what they're capable of doing? And I guess what I'm asking is, do they sometimes try to cover up for what they're feeling, to put on a good face or to make it seem like they are more capable than they've really become?
I think if people are asked about what they can do, they will usually say. I think the problem is more often that they're not asked. I think it is true that people will often not volunteer symptoms. They'll assume that it's perfectly normal to have chest pain every morning because, after all, they're 88 years old and they expect to have a certain amount of discomfort. So they may not come right out and tell a physician about a problem that would be important to divulge. I think the other fact that is important here is that older people often have atypical symptoms, so that an older patient with a heart attack may not have the crushing substernal chest pain going down the left arm with sweating and shortness of breath that's in the textbooks and that often describes what younger patients feel. So it may not be that the person is covering up or refusing to tell. It's that they actually have symptoms that are trickier to pin down.
Why are they trickier?
Because they're not the classic symptoms. If I give you an example. Often acute confusion is the presentation of severe disease, and that disease can be pneumonia, it can be a heart attack, it can be a urinary tract infection. It's a lot easier to figure out what's going on if the person with the urinary tract infection has pain when he goes to the bathroom, or the person with pneumonia has cough and fever and shortness of breath. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, older people may not have any of those things and instead just have confusion, and you're left with trying to figure out what the cause of the confusion actually is.
You know, a lot of the patients who you see are you know, quite elderly, and they're probably very different now than they were when they were younger. When they were younger, they might have been active professionally or had a very vigorous home and family life. Do the patients often want to tell you who they used to be before they became frail or before they became sick?
Often patients do want to talk about their lives, and sometimes for people who don't volunteer that information, I find it nonetheless useful to ask them about their lives. It gives me a deeper, richer sense of who they are now if I can understand who they were before.
How does that help you?
Well, it helps me in understanding what's important to them. There's certainly, I said before that in contemplating medical treatment, people have to think about what they're trying to achieve, what their goals are. I also talked earlier about how sometimes a person may not want a cane or a walker because they would rather not be safe in exchange for a sense of dignity. So understanding who they've been all their lives can give me a better sense of what's likely to be important to them today. Now, people change, so it's not necessarily the case that the person who's always been fiercely independent is still going to be fiercely independent today, but it certainly gives a strong clue.
My guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick. Her new book is called Lifelines. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick. She directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program, and she's the Director of Medical Education at the Hebrew Rehabilitation Center for the Aged. She's written a new book called Lifelines, Living Longer, Growing Frail, Taking Heart. I'm sure that you're often in the position of suggesting to one of your older patients that it's time to use a hearing aid or get a walker or start using oxygen regularly. And I think those kinds of things indicate that somebody has crossed a line. They can no longer walk on their own. They need an aid. They can no longer breathe on their own. They need an aid. Or they can't hear on their own. And because those aids are visible, it's like saying to the rest of the world, I can no longer walk myself. I can no longer hear myself. And as a result of that, I think sometimes older people are very reluctant to take the step that they need to take because it symbolizes something to them and to the rest of the world. Do you find that to be true a lot?
I do. I think it's interesting when older people move into, for example, an assisted living facility, a building where everybody has their own apartment, they have some degree of privacy, but they also have communal areas and dining room for everyone, have some degree of assistance. The reaction of many of my patients on entering such a facility is, everybody else here is very old. And what they are often saying is they don't see themselves as needing those kinds of aids that you describe. They have a hard time recognizing that they're in that position too. Amusingly, perhaps, if someone enters a nursing home where 90% of the residents are using a walker, it often is a lot easier to persuade an individual to use a walker because that's par for the course. That's what everybody's using. It's much more socially acceptable. So I think that these kinds of devices do have a great deal of symbolic meaning to people and make it hard for them to accept them.
Are you often in the position of trying to convince an older person that even though they don't want to use it, even though it will make them feel uncomfortable on the outside, that they have to use the cane or they have to use the oxygen?
Well, I do sometimes try to persuade people to use things that they don't want to use, but I think we also have to respect their autonomy, and if their sense of self is so devastated by using a cane, for example, and they're willing to take the consequences of a fall, perhaps even a fracture, in exchange for holding on to the sense of who they are a little bit longer, then that's ultimately their choice to make.
Now, what about depression? Do you find that that's a pretty widespread problem among older people?
It is a very common problem, and I found in thinking about frailty for this book that there are a lot of people who are tipped over the edge because on top of all their physical ailments, they developed depression. And they were perhaps able to cope if they had to take so many pills for high blood pressure and insulin for diabetes and wear trifocals. But when they become depressed on top, it just makes it very difficult to keep going.
So many older people are already on so many drugs treating, you know, heart problems and blood pressure problems and breathing problems and so on. So if you add an antidepressant to that, what are the odds that the antidepressant is going to interact badly with one of the many drugs the person's already taking?
Well, certainly interaction amongst drugs is a big issue in frail elderly patients. The newer antidepressants, the SSRIs, Prozac and its cousins, tend to have fewer side effects and fewer interactions. The tricyclic antidepressants, which are still very good drugs and in certain circumstances are the drugs of choice, are more likely to cause problems. In my book, I talk about one gentleman who developed urinary retention, who couldn't go to the bathroom when he was started on a tricyclic antidepressant. And in fact, the physician caring for him thought that he needed to have prostate surgery, when really what he needed to have was his antidepressant discontinued, and if he needed an antidepressant to be put on a different one. So, yes, drugs are perilous, but they also can be terrifically helpful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick, and she directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. She's the author of the new book, Lifelines, Living Longer, Growing Frail, Taking Heart. Are there times when you're really not sure whether treating a problem is the correct thing to do because the person is so frail that the new drug or the new treatment might worsen their quality of life in a way that doesn't make it pay off?
Yeah, I think there are lots of treatments that would make great sense for someone who's very vigorous, and where one has to ask whether the side effects of that treatment, the long-term consequences of their treatment, make it worthwhile for a frail older person. And one of the things that I really enjoy doing is trying to make people and their families, because families are typically a very important part of decision-making, understand what the ramifications are of engaging in a certain course of therapy. The most extreme example is something like surgery, or being in an intensive care unit, or having attempted cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Not just will these things work short term, but what will the long term consequences be, and is it worthwhile to undertake those risks?
How do you help a person decide whether the risks are worth it or not?
What I like to do is to try to talk to people about what matters to them most at that stage of their lives. And the way I tend to think about this is, are people primarily interested in a treatment that will offer them a chance of life prolongation, no matter what the cost? Is that the most important goal for them? Is their most important goal maintaining the functions that they have, hearing, seeing, walking, talking, whatever it is that they are engaged in on a daily basis that really matters to them? Or are they at a point in their lives when the major goal is just to be kept comfortable? And of course, most people want all three of those things. So what I like to do is to talk to people about establishing priorities, trying to figure out which of those is most important at a given point in time, and then looking at whatever intervention we're talking about, whatever treatment we're talking about, and trying to explain to them what consequences I think that treatment will have in terms of their goals, which form of treatment is most likely to achieve the goals that they have for themselves.
You write in your book that when you see patients who are old and frail, you can't help but wonder what keeps them going, what sustains them spiritually as their bodies disappoint or betray them. What are some of the answers you found to that question about what keeps people going?
Well, I think one of the major things that keeps people going is relationships. That in all the individuals that I describe in the book, their friendships, their family are probably the most important in sustaining them. I think that people often need even more than that, and they need to have some sort of occupation, if you will, that they can find meaningful. And that's sometimes not possible to do in a way that's similar to what they've ever done before, and that creates a challenge. But I've had patients who delight in spending time with preschoolers, reading to them, or children in elementary school, telling them what life was like in earlier days. Many frail older people have incredible recollections. I remember having one patient who died when she was 98, and I think I took care of her the last 2 or 3 years of her life. And she had grown up in New York City, she remembered New York City in the 20s. And it was fascinating to listen to her talk about what life was like then. She was a great social historian. I think that we need to tap into recollections that people have about different times and places, and that's a meaningful and rewarding kind of activity for the teller of the story and for the listener. I talk about examples of people becoming involved in whatever community they're in, even if it's a nursing home, to be involved in some kind of council or committee in which the residents of that nursing home help influence policy, help shape their lives in that environment. Those are things that benefit others and benefit the individual in question, that help give meaning to life, even someone who's quite physically frail.
Well, Dr. Gillick, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Muriel Gillick is the author of the new book, Lifelines. She directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new series of live jazz recordings. This is Fresh Air. Jazz fans may know Baltimore, Maryland, as the birthplace of pianists Ubi Blake and Cyrus Chestnut, drummer Chick Webb, and saxophonist Gary Bartz and Gary Thomas, among others, and as the place where Billie Holiday grew up. Nowadays, it's becoming known as a town jazz musicians went to as well as came from. Critic Kevin Whitehead explains.
Stan Getz, Baltimore, 1975. According to some versions of jazz history, the 70s was the dark ages, when musicians either sold out and got funky or went into hibernation. In fact, a lot of jazz mainstreamers didn't give up and kept working the club and concert trail. One likely stop was the famous ballroom, 1717 North Charles Street in Baltimore. From 1966 to 84, the Left Bank Jazz Society presented concerts there on Sundays from 5 to 9 p.m. Many of them were taped, and some of those recordings are now being issued by Label M. Four volumes dribbled out in the fall, with 8 or 10 more expected this year. The first batch is heavy on tenor saxophonists, including that Stan Getz date we just heard from, with bassist Dave Holland and drummer Jack DeJohnette, and a 1968 face-off between tenors Al Cohn and Zoot Sims. Sims with the audience at Baltimore's famous ballroom. These amateur recordings by the Left Bank Jazz Society's Vernon Welsh do a good job of catching the ambience of the room. I spent a lot of Sundays there myself in the 70s and 80s, but only after moving away did I realize how special that place was. Jazz has rarely been so user-friendly. You could bring the kids and get them home by bedtime. You could also buy cheap beer or setups and exemplary fried chicken and collard greens, then sit at one of the long picnic tables in front of the bandstand and pig out on three full sets of music. The audience at the famous was always predisposed to having a good time, but a long way from being a pushover. That attitude often inspired musicians to give a little extra. Not that the music was always brilliant. The first four Left Bank CDs range from the okay to the very good. Unlike the shows, they tend to be a bit short, averaging about 53 minutes each. The standout is a 1971 trio date by Sonny Stitt on electric saxophone, which gave him an odd but oddly appealing tone. This is from Who Can I Turn To? Sonny Stitt, organist Don Patterson, and drummer Billy James. The Left Bank Jazz Society presented concerts at various halls around Baltimore before and after the famous ballroom. But gradually, their activities tapered off until they suspended operations in 1998 due to a shortage of funds. But there's a happy ending. The money the Left Bank makes from licensing these CDs has enabled them to resume their Sunday concerts, at least occasionally. I've heard jazz at hip venues all over two continents, but for atmosphere, nothing has surpassed those Sunday evenings in Baltimore. It's good that they survive, live and on record.
Kevin Whitehead is based in Chicago. He reviewed the Left Bank Jazz Series on Label M. Four recordings in the series have been released. More are on the way. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from the Sonny Stitt recording from the Live at the Left Bank series. He's playing a song by Brazilian guitarist and composer Luis Bonfa, who died Friday at the age of 78.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Deep in the Heart, a debut novel about love, motherhood, and family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the politics of presidential transitions. We talk with Mark Guerin, former deputy director of Bill Clinton's transition team, and Boyden Gray, director of the Transition Council's office for George Bush Sr. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.